Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In 30 minutes, we'll cut through the noise with interviews, insight, and straight answers from people who make the decisions. You'll leave knowing more than when you arrived. Coming up on the program today, South Africa tells Washington the G20 is not your private club. Treat us as equals. Africa's workforce speaks about hope, fear, and a fast-changing future. Clean audit number 11, Drakenstein claims the crown. Can other municipalities copy the model? And South Africa's most expensive cyber risk is one careless click. It's Monday, the 8th of December. Tension between Pretoria and Washington, as you well know, has hit a new high. The United States, now presiding over the G20, has formally excluded South Africa from next year's meetings, prompting Pretoria to announce that it will take what it terms a commercial break from the forum until the next presidency cycles around. At the same time, the Foreign Minister, Ronald Lamola, has responded sharply to U.S. demands, insisting that South Africa will not bow to external pressure and does not need American approval. Let's pull all of that together. I'm in conversation now with Vincent Magwenya, who speaks for the presidency. Vincent, you've described, and welcome to you, South Africa's next year's absence from the G20 as a commercial break. What exactly does that mean in practice? Will the country still engage in any formal or working level G20 meetings, or is this a complete diplomatic pause?
So thank you, Jeremy, for having me. And well, here's what we're doing, Jeremy. We are currently engaged with all the G20 countries, except for the United States, on the substance of the outcomes of the Johannesburg summit with respect to advancing those issues and ensuring that those issues remain in the agenda. Albeit with some difficulty, because the United States has already shown that it will have total disregard of those issues. Secondly, we're discussing with our G20 member partners the issue around the principle of multilateralism, as well as the rules and norms of the G20, that no country can unilaterally single out or exclude another member. As you know, South Africa is a founding member of the G20. It does not need to be invited. Its participation is automatic and it's a given. However, the American authorities do have at their disposal instruments that they can use to frustrate or inhibit our participation, so to speak. That's what we are doing. With that comment that I made on X of a commercial break, that was a lighthearted way of saying we recognize that we may not be able to engage fully, substantively, and meaningfully, considering all these hurdles that have been placed before us. We are, however, looking beyond 2026 and looking at the G20 in 2027 presidency, and it is our firm belief, with a great deal of confidence, that there will be a platform where we'll be able to once again engage more substantively and meaningfully, as well as to ourselves, as the continent, as South Africa as well.
Whichever way you look at it, though, the US's decision to exclude South Africa does set a dangerous precedent, does it not, for multilateral institutions?
That's the point we are making to all our G20 partners and member countries, that this sets a very bad precedent in terms of the G20 itself, its standing, its rules and norms, as well as its broader credibility. It's a dangerous path from a multilateral point of view, to have one country utilizing what you could essentially describe as a bilateral dispute and bringing it to a multilateral platform and clouding that platform over its own bilateral issues. And this is something that all countries actually do recognize as a challenge and a problem. And we believe they will be undertaking their own quiet engagements with the U.S. to express their concerns as well as their displeasure with the approach that the U.S. has adopted.
What kind of signals then are you getting from other G20 members in that respect? Are they also expressing a degree of concern or disquiet?
They've been extremely supportive, and they've also expressed a very large degree of concern and disquiet, and they've undertaken to also raise these issues in their own bilateral engagements with the U.S. You will have seen the statement coming from the German Chancellor about South Africa's role in the G20 and the need to continue participating, with the Chancellor undertaking to engage President Trump on these issues. And so there is a level of support. Remember, Jeremy, that as late as 2022, there were attempts to remove Russia from the G20 following the invasion in Ukraine. And those attempts did not succeed because there was no consensus amongst all the members. And so the G20 has to continue with its well-established rules and norms, and they cannot just randomly and overnight be altered by one member just because they have the responsibility to lead the group for a year.
The difficulty, of course, is for South Africa to ensure that its trade relationships, its foreign investment flows, and relationships with other global partners aren't adversely affected by this diplomatic freeze with Washington. And that's a real possibility, isn't it?
No, not really. Our trade, diplomatic and bilateral relations with all other countries up to date have not been affected at all by the diplomatic dynamic with Washington. In fact, I'll go as far as saying even our own trade with the U.S. has not been impacted, barring for the products and the goods that have been levied with higher tariffs. We've seen an adjustment in some food goods that because of the high consumer prices in the U.S., there's been an adjustment on those tariffs. And so there's still a significant amount of trade taking place between ourselves and the U.S. In fact, Jeremy, we are positively now focusing on what we call functional aspects of the relationship with the U.S., people-to-people exchanges, business-to-business relationships with civil society, academia, and so on. We were extremely pleased to see a very high number of U.S. businesses represented during the B20 in the lead-up to the G20, and that showed us that at a people-to-people, business-to-business sort of level, you have a very functional relationship, which is the one that we would like to preserve, focus our energies on more, make sure that U.S. businesses feel welcomed in South Africa, that the investment climate is conducive for them to invest and participate in the South African economy. And that encourages us, and that's where we're going to throw a lot of our energies into, accepting that at the highest level of political leadership, it may be impossible to reset the relationship.
Just very quickly, you will concede, though, that it's going to be difficult for Pretoria to protect our influence in global and economic climate discussions because we're absent from formal G20 forums during the course of 2026.
Not quite. I won't concede because we're still part of the Sherpa network with the other countries. So college, we're still in the loop, if you like, of the discussions that are going to ensue as early as the 16th of December. That's number one. Number two, France has already extended a formal invitation for South Africa's participation in the G7 meetings. So we're going to be the invited country there. And there are also other multilateral platforms where South Africa's views and participation is continuously sought after. And so this is a temporary blip, as I sort of in a tongue-in-cheek way referred it to a commercial break, but it does not have a contaminating effect in to other platforms as well as other opportunities of engagement.
Vincent Magwenya from the Presidency, thank you very much for talking to us today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
A new report from PwC finds African workers are embracing artificial intelligence a whole lot faster than the rest of the world, around 64% using AI at work in the past year. And there's also strong optimism about how technology is going to improve quality and productivity. But, and here's the rub, the data also reveals a warning. Only a third of employees in Africa believe their skills will still be relevant in the next 3 years. Let's discuss this in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with Martley Duplessis, Workforce of the Future Lead at PwC Africa. Martley, a very warm welcome to you. So the survey shows this continent adopting AI faster than global peers. What is driving that acceleration, in your opinion?
Thank you very much, Jeremy. There's a few factors that we need to take into consideration. And I do think we need to see this in the broader context of the world of work. The first one is that when we have conversations with executives, and also if we read the report, is that employees is using Gen AI, and they are using it to increase their productivity and their creativity and their output. But we are seeing that the integration into formal workforce practices, strategies, the use of agents which could potentially change the shape of teams, that is still lacking a bit. And I think that is why a lot of these employees are positive about it, because they're experiencing the positive output of the tool. But we are yet to see what will happen if it's fully integrated into the workplace.
And what do you think is stopping that full integration?
I think we are still getting to grips in terms of how do we govern, how do we control, how do we manage the responsible use of Gen AI, and how do we make sure that we learn as we go along. If you use Gen AI in an irresponsible way, the outcome can really be detrimental. So I do think Africa and South African businesses are still grappling with how do we create the guardrails along the use of Gen AI.
So how do employers then start to move more quickly to close the skills gap and build the guardrails?
We have lots of conversations with the executives at the moment that realize that many of their employees have a basic understanding, but the majority of employees still do not use or understand the impact that Gen AI can have. CEOs are starting to drive the upskilling initiative quite strongly. They are instructing human capital and technology teams to work collectively to ensure that there's a similar understanding and baseline of skills across the business. We are also seeing that they are creating particular personas in organizations, and they tailor skills development programs according to that. And human capital teams are starting to embrace the concept of Gen AI to the degree where they are building it into policies and procedures. It is moving fast, though, in the sense of agentic workforce. And that's really where you're starting to use agents, bots, instead of humans. And that is something that they are now next trying to build into workforce design.
Who in an organization takes responsibility for this process and integration, do you think?
That's a very good question, and it varies. Human capital teams are most definitely involved because the human element is so critically important. The technical knowledge, so technology teams are involved, your digital teams are involved, AI teams are involved, and your strategists are involved. So it is not something that is particularly owned by one function per se. It's more a collective task team that addresses it from various angles, and that's absolutely the right way of doing it.
But difficult to harness all of those angles, given that this is all moving with such speed these days. Surely you need one person in an organization, almost like a chief AI officer these days.
Yes, from a job perspective, there would be either the task team leader, or it will be then the function that the business identifies. So it can be the technology lead or the AI lead, but it definitely varies. We are, however, seeing that this is a director from the CEO level, and it's oftentimes sponsored by the CEO, but delivered by somebody else within the organization.
Martle, your report also says that South African executives are reporting a major productivity gain from AI. Can you mine down a little more deeply into that? What type of productivity gains are we seeing here, and in what sectors?
Yes, absolutely. Financial services, most definitely. And I think it is because employees are using the tools like ChatGPT, Copilot, etc., to mine data, to mine information, to draw reports, to summarize emails, minutes, notes, to make suggestions and recommendations. So that saves up quite a bit of time. The interesting thing is, because of that productivity, it is going to lead to a different expectation from employees in the future. We also believe that some of the jobs may reduce in future if it is correctly built into the fiber of an organization. And I think organizational structures, the shape and form of a structure, is going to change completely. It is definitely going to flatten the organizational structure. And a lot of questions are being asked at the moment in terms of entry-level jobs. What does that look like in future?
And just a final one, you call for, if I've read this correctly, the embedding of AI into workforce strategy. Explain to me what that means and what happens to organizations that continue treating it as a side project rather than, as you've outlined to me, a core capability.
Yeah, Jeremy, you can't treat it as a byproduct anymore. You will lose your competitive edge, and the gap to close in on will become too wide. It is critically important that you identify how your business is going to create value in future, taking all of these mega trends into consideration. Then identify how you are going to use AI in the deepest form, Gen AI, agentic workforce, etc., to increase the delivery of that value, and then to design your business bottom up. So in other words, to design Gen AI agents into the processes of your businesses, to the point when you can start to make decisions to say, am I going to recruit a human being or am I going to recruit a bot? How many bot managers do I need in future? How many human being leaders do I need in future? And if you don't start to think about it in that granular level, you're going to miss out on the benefit that it can give you.
Thank you very much indeed for that look into the future. That's Martle du Plessis, Workforce of the Future Lead at PwC Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Let's turn our attention now to local administration and specifically Drakenstein, a municipality that has once again clinched a clean audit and has been crowned the best in the Western Cape. Under the stewardship of the Deputy Mayor Gert Kombrink, Drakenstein municipality claiming 11 consecutive clean audits and multiple awards for governance, sustainability and innovation. So obviously some lessons to be learnt here. Yet while the accolades do pile up, many South African municipalities continue to struggle. So my question is, Drakenstein truly a model of excellence? And if so, how replicable is that success elsewhere? Councillor Kombrink, a very warm welcome to you. 11 consecutive clean audits, as I mentioned. It's impressive. But I guess your challenge is to guard against the danger that audit compliance becomes a goal in itself rather than improving real service delivery for ordinary residents. How do you strike that balance?
Jeremy, we always say that a clean audit does not mean good service delivery. So we look at it separately. Clean audit is fine. It's an unqualified audit with no findings. And we've got about 15 unqualified audits back to back, and then the 11 clean audits. But the day you become complacent about your clean audits, that's the day when you've got a problem. Clean audit is basically an unqualified audit with no matters, as I said. And it comes by design, not by default. So it's hard work. You must make sure that your oversight is in place, that your leadership at the administrative side is sound leadership and knowledgeable people. You shouldn't appoint somebody that's not knowledgeable in this field of the finances.
Let's break that up. I want to talk about design, then we can talk about oversight. But design, first of all, Councillor, given that the rest of South Africa's municipalities in many respects are failing, are there concrete lessons from Drakenstein that can realistically be replicated elsewhere? But you've also, I guess, got to consider differences in economy, political context and resources.
Yes, Jeremy. It's basically you go back to your MFMA, that's your Municipal Finance Management Act, and you follow the prescripts that's in the Act. So you start with your IDP process, the integrated development process, because your IDP guides your budget that follows the IDP. And as soon as you start the budgeting process, what we in Drakenstein is doing is we always say if you have capital projects that you as a department want to implement, you must be spending ready when you go to the budget steering committees in February, which is just a month before your March 90-day budget hits the table. And by saying spending ready, you must have a tender in place. You must have a roll-out business plan in place for your capital project. And then after the budget is finally in May approved, then we can start implementing. And 14 days after the budget is approved, then you come out with your service delivery budget implementation plan. And then the oversight from the political side is to follow that plan and make sure that it happens. For instance, we are already at the end of October spent on our capital by 70.1%. Not actual spending, that's actual plus the commitments. Mm-hmm. There's always look at it that way. Our actual spending is 11.9% and the commitments is 60.1%. And commitments is only a commitment if there's an order issued and the tender in place and you know the work is going to be done. We've achieved 98.5% capital expenditure in the previous financial year. So then what we also do is on the audit plan, the Auditor General always give you a list of stuff that you must look at. Then they call it the Municipal Audit Action Plan. They call it MAP. And we've broken that down to a departmental audit action plan. It's the only place in South Africa that you will find that. And why we do it is because then you can monitor what is implemented in that action plan of the Auditor General. And you can follow it department by department. By doing that, you make sure that there's no mishap along the line.
Providing, of course, that you can guarantee that all of that translates, Councillor, into tangible improvements in infrastructure, basic services and quality of life for all communities and not the most visible wards. How do you find that that equality, that balance?
There are basically in the National Treasury different grants that you can apply for. And one of those is the BFI grant, that's a basic facility for infrastructure. And that facility comes with a prescript. It must be spent in previously disadvantaged areas. We received a 4.5 billion rand grant in 2 years ago, spread over a four-year period. And that grant we cannot use to spend in any other area than previous disadvantaged areas. So we must find other money. Let's take, for instance, burst pipes. Every municipality has a problem with burst pipes due to age of pipes. So the burst pipes and the old pipes in the previously disadvantaged areas is covered by that BFI grant. And then in the other area, we must find other money in the normal budget.
Just a final question then, and let's get back to oversight and transparency. How transparent is your decision-making and budget allocation process, Councillor, to residents, particularly in communities that may lack the resources to hold your municipality to account?
Okay, what we do is in our the month of April, after we've done the draft budget, then we go out to all communities and they have community meetings. And it takes usually from 4 o'clock until 7 o'clock at night to give the people a chance to come. And then all the departments will sit there with their section of the budget, and the people, the local people, can come and ask any questions, and every official is then empowered with these documents to give the answers to the people. Then we make a list of all the input from the community, and that must be added to your main budget in May, so that everybody can see that there was community participation. There are lists of needs of communities, and not everything can be accommodated in the first budget that comes, but there are also outer years. So we do a four-year outer year budget. You've got your budget, and then your medium-term revenue and expenditure framework, which is the second, third, and the fourth year.
I'm going to leave it there, and thank you very much indeed for that detailed explanation, Deputy Mayor Gert Kombrink from the Drakenstein Municipality. I do appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, cybersecurity may be smarter and more sophisticated than ever, but South African businesses are still losing millions of rands because of something that no software can fully fix. What am I talking about? Well, human error. With local data breaches costing an average of 44 million rand and 88% of cyber attacks linked to someone clicking the wrong link, it's a real problem. Well, IT company QWERTY director Craig Freer says the front line of cyber defense has shifted, he says, from firewalls to employees. Let's interrogate that in a little more detail. Craig, a very warm welcome to you. 88% of attacks I've just mentioned traced back to human error. Are businesses over-investing in tools, do you think, and under-investing in people?
I think the answer to that is yes and no. What you've got is you've got businesses investing a lot in tools, but they're only as good as the way they're configured and set up. So I think the starting point in the cybersecurity industries is really about whatever you're investing into is making sure that those are configured in line with best practice policies, best practice cyber policies. But there's no doubt that businesses are ignoring the risk of the employee right now. And we're seeing a very, very big shift from the traditional target the network, target the firewall, try get through on a ransomware attack, to exploiting the individual, exploiting the one weakness that sits in an organization, and using that to actually get in and compromise the cyber standards and cybersecurity software that's been put in place.
So a couple of questions around that. First of all, do you think organizations are honest enough these days about how vulnerable their own staff really are?
I don't think that it's an honesty thing. I think it's almost a level of ignorance. A lot of organizations are not really aware of how big that risk is. But certainly from our perspective, we're seeing probably every cyber breach right now coming through an employee and not through a network risk.
So attackers these days know a lot more personal detail about employees than in the past. Companies then need to do a lot more to protect that digital footprint. But again, it seems they're falling short.
Absolutely. And, you know, what you've got now is cyber criminals have become the new digital marketers. And, you know, the old days of the Nigerian scam with poor spelling that caught people, those really are over. You've got these criminals, they're impersonating global brands like Microsoft. They're impersonating CEOs. They're going down to the level of impersonating a CEO's voice or even video footage. And they're using a lot of AI to do this. And they're getting into organizations that are understanding HR structures, and they're starting to impersonate that. And they're using that to target individuals that are coming actually from a comfort level. And that's the way they're actually starting to get in.
And to your point, deep fake voices, AI-generated messages are getting harder and harder to detect. We must surely be close to a point where even well-trained staff can't tell the difference.
There is always ways of checking it. And, you know, a lot of and I'm going to go back to what the biggest attack we're seeing at the moment is what's called business email compromise. In fact, we're actually dealing with one at the moment. And what happens is, They compromise an account, they will get into an account, and they will then take over email effectively. And they'll use some technology to effectively hide. And what at some point they will do is they will put out a mail to all of your suppliers or your debtors, and you'll say, please note that our bank account details have changed, and people will pay money into the wrong account, and that money's gone. I mean, we're dealing with one now for about 7 million rand. And these are type of numbers that can break a business. So a lot of it comes down to putting the right controls in place from a technology perspective, but also from an HR perspective, making sure that processes are right, making sure that banking details don't get changed without a full audit trail behind it and sign off behind it and checks and balances that get in place. So a lot of this comes down to number one is actually building it into HR manuals, taking it very, very seriously, making sure staff are aware of what the expectations are. And then from there, starting to test people. And it's an inexpensive exercise to do simulated phishing exercises. And what you're doing is you're simulating a phishing attack on your employees. You're picking up people that are actually clicking links that they shouldn't be, for example. And then what you do is you put them into the proverbial naughty corner, and they have to go through a series of cyber training events that gets them back onto a point where they shouldn't be doing this type of thing.
So to push that a little further, cybersecurity, you're suggesting, should be in the employee handbook. Beyond that, should it become part of performance management?
Absolutely. And it's something that's got to be written into disciplinary code as well. You just cannot have rogue employees doing silly things like accepting multi-factor authentication or clicking a link that they shouldn't. They've got to be able to learn and understand what are risks, what are anomalies, and what just shouldn't be done. In my opinion, it's almost down to the level of saying you shouldn't steal from the organization. Well, it's that level of type of HR policy that needs to be put in place. And it needs to be enforced. I think that's the other thing that's quite key. It's all very well building it into an HR policy, training people once off. But unless you're enforcing it over and over and over, and you're regularly training people and testing people, then it falls by the wayside after a period of time.
So beyond that, surely boards of directors need to start treating human error in this respect as a core governance risk, and that doesn't seem to be happening.
Correct. And that's if you look at most of the cyber frameworks that are put in place, what they're saying now is that risk committees actually need to evolve to include a full cyber element of it, and it's got to be part and parcel of the full discipline of the organization's risk policies and procedures.
Thank you very much indeed, Craig Freer from QWERTY. I appreciate your time today. Thank you. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.